Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars. And we have today another amazing More Than Ordinary guest, longtime friend of mine, Karen Mackey, who is an attorney and works in the city of Sioux City, Iowa, where she is going to shatter all of your stereotypes about women, Native Americans, attorneys, anything else that you could think of. So, Karen.
Yes.
Let's dive right in. We were talking about Hidden Figures, the movie about the women who were mathematicians, engineers for NASA, African-American women back in the late 50s, early 60s, and the similarities in some ways with people like you and I who went to school 15 years later. So I'd just like to dive right in a little bit and give people a little background about yourself, your history.
Okay. So I was born and raised in Sioux City, Iowa. I am an enrolled member of the Santee Sioux Tribe of Nebraska. My father's Native and my mother's white. I went to undergraduate school at Morningside College in Sioux City and went to law school at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln.
And you now work for the city as?
Yes, I'm the executive director of the Sioux City Human Rights Commission.
And so let's start with Morningside College. It's a private institution, right, in Iowa?
Yes, it is.
And it's a fairly well-regarded institution. So I'm just going to take a wild guess and suspect that there isn't a large Native American population attending there.
There were not very many, although there were a few when I was there, and we had a small Native American group. There were maybe a dozen of us or so. Actually, at the time that when I first went there, my father was a professor there.
Really?
Yes. And we did have an Indian Studies department for a while.
So that was really exceptional for that time, yes?
It was, very much so.
And do you think that helped you any? Because, I mean, for me, when I went to school, Native American, Latino students, even African American students were like pepper in the salt shaker. It was really, students really stood out. Until I was in graduate school getting my PhD, which would have been like 15 years after I started as a freshman, there weren't any kind of Native American studies programs, Latino studies programs, at least that I was aware of, around the schools I attended. So how was that for you? Do you think the Indian Studies program helped you that it was there, or was it not a factor?
I think it did. I only took a couple of classes from the Indian Studies department, but it was interesting. And it was helpful just that there were other Native people. My father was not the only Native professor at the college, and it's a small college. They only have probably 2,500 students. So that was helpful. And talking about what it's like to be, yes, pepper in the salt shaker, law school was very much that way. There were 5 Native Americans in my entering class of law school. Only 4 of us graduated.
Well, and this is one of the things that I think people, when there's very, very few, a lot of people, I know I ran into this even when I was in sports reporting, and you're here because you're a woman and you're a minority and you meet these diversity quotas that people want to put in quotes, not that you actually have qualifications. And there's that idea around it. Was that something you encountered, being one of the few minority women in your law school, I'm sure?
Oh, constantly. I'm really good at standardized tests. That's how I got into law school.
Now, I wondered how you dealt with that, Karen, because you're way nicer than me. And anybody who knows the both of us will agree to this. And when people would say stupid, racist things to me, I literally told them to go fuck themselves. I was at the Centro Cultural Chicano one time at UC Riverside, and I had Rhonda with me, who is kind of blonde. And I had come in there before with Maria, and they're like, ay, que linda niña, quieres una galleta? And I came in with Rhonda, and people just acted as if I had brought in cockroaches. And I did. I said, you know, my baby's beautiful and amazing. You can go fuck yourselves. Mm-hmm. But then it was the same thing on the flip side when I would go to like faculty meetings and people would say things like, oh, you've got a lot of nerve getting in here on, you know, an affirmative action scholarship and mm-hmm. having these white kids. And I said, you know what? I got in here because I had kick-ass GRE scores and I was an engineer before this program. And I don't know how the hell you got in here. But you are a much nicer person than me. So I always wondered if hypothetically I had been a nice person, how I would deal with that kind of racism from both sides.
You know, I wasn't always so nice in dealing with it in law school. Because I had no shame about saying, I got in here because I had a hot LSAT. I'll bet my score was higher than yours. And I would tell them what my score was.
You grew up, you're half Native, half white. You'd never lived on a reservation. You're saying you have a lot of family on reservations. But what was it like kind of being in both worlds? Especially a lot of times it's kind of like you're not Native enough for some Native people and you're not white enough for white people. And what was that kind of like, and how did you balance that dynamic between that whole biracial factor that a lot of people, I'd say, are dealing with, whether it's half white, half black, half mm-hmm. Latino? But how was that for you, and what did you do to kind of...
So, you know, being born in the 50s, there weren't a whole lot of us who were biracial running around. And then we lived in a part of town of Sioux City that was almost entirely white. There were no blacks in Morningside. Morningside is not only a college, but it's the part of town I grew up in. So there were no African Americans. There were almost no Asians. In fact, my high school class was 350 kids, no blacks, one Asian, five Native Americans, and about five or six Hispanic people. That's it. And that was by the time I got to high school. So when I was a little kid, it was literally me and my cousins. We had this little, you know, Native ghetto there. So, you know, I was walking distance between a couple of different relatives. And then the one Native family in the area moved in right across the street from us. There were some of our neighbors, I think, that were just shitting their pants, that there were just all these Indians around. And when I was a kid, especially in the summer, I tanned very well. You know, back in the day, it wasn't like kids now sitting at home playing on your computer. You were outside. Oh, so anyhow, so in the summer, I would get really dark. So when I was real little, one summer, my mother actually tried to get me to play in the shade all the time, which really pissed me off. And then she laid outside every day for hours. It was because when we would go somewhere in public, people would ask her who the little Indian kid was she was babysitting.
Yeah, I always wonder if they'd ask if you were adopted.
Yeah, she gave birth to me. She wanted credit for me. And so it really pissed her off. It really pissed me off playing in the shade. Yeah, growing up in Morningside was different, being one of the very few minorities there. And you know, there is this thing, especially in Sioux City, and there's a lot of Native people in Sioux City. We have the highest population of Native people in the state of Iowa. In fact, I would dare say there's more members of my tribe living in Sioux City than are on our reservation, probably significantly more. There's a lot of Native people here. They don't live in Morningside, probably not even now. There are not a lot of Native people in Morningside still. So, you know, 40, 50 years ago, there weren't many at all. So when I would interact with Native people, you know, they didn't necessarily consider me Native because I wasn't living in their neighborhoods and my mom was white. So I would get that from Native people, you're not a real Indian. And then with white people, I was too Indian for them. And my experience growing up also was impacted because my father had a master's degree. You know, he got his master's degree the year I started kindergarten. So my life was very different than most Native people in our community, which actually was something I grew up hearing. I had advantages that other Natives rarely had, and that I needed to make something of my life and help our people because of that.
Well, and did your parents say anything to you about it? Did they address it? Because it's kind of one of those things where, I mean, it must have come up or things like that. Was that conversations you guys had at home?
That was interesting because my parents were two very different people. So my dad grew up on the reservation, third of six boys. You know, he grew up fighting. And he just kind of assumed, I was their first child, he just kind of assumed I ought to be able to fight. That didn't work out so well. In fact, I have a scar on my back to prove it. I ran home, tried to get inside. My mother had the screen door latched. And meanwhile, the girl bit me in the back.
A girl bit you in the back?
Yes. So I have a scar in the small of my back from it.
Why did she bite you?
I have no idea. We were, who knows, but she bit me. And
how old were you?
I was maybe 4. Yeah. So that night, my father took me out back. I was expecting sympathy. You know, he came home from school. I'm laying there on the couch, an ice pack on my back. My mother's all upset. And my father's like, what the hell? Didn't you hit her back? And took me outside and decided to teach me how to fight.
And you were 4?
I was 4. And so he was very happy a few weeks later when some boy's dad came to him bitching that I'd hit his son, who was 5, so he was older than me. My dad's like, good. Good for her.
You're like Baby Fight Club.
Yes. And, you know, my entire life, he would randomly teach me self-defense things or talk about fighting. You know, when I was in high school and started to go to football games, he would insist that I take a roll of pennies with me and stick it in my pocket, in my right-hand pocket. He didn't give me a roll of dimes.
In case you got in a fight, right? And you need to pull that out and punch somebody.
Right.
See, Maria, I wasn't the only parent like that. Yes. When Maria went off to college, I told her, look, you're a little person. If you get in a fight in a bar or you get somewhere in those chairs, those like lightweight chairs that have the metal things in them, I said, pick it up and swing it over your head because you can do some serious damage.
Yep.
And she said, Mom, other people's moms are telling them to like not forget to put in the fabric softener.
No, my dad was constantly like, here's how you beat someone up if they attack you. In fact, one time I was walking behind him to get to my chair in the dining room. And I could see he had this funny look in his eyes, and I moved my feet. Good thing he kicked a hole in the wall. So he just, like, kicked straight back with his heel, put a hole in the wall. That was aimed for me.
Always be ready!
Exactly. Always be ready. And he had actually studied jiu-jitsu when he was stationed in Japan for a while. And so I finally realized a few years ago that what he was teaching me that whole time was jiu-jitsu.
We'll be right back.
Did you know that 92% of U.S. homes have a computer? Yes. Yes, they do. And 43% of homes have a child under 18. Why aren't more kids playing educational games on those computers? Because they suck. The educational games, not the kids. Until now, download Spirit Lake or Fish Lake. Check out Forgotten Trail or Making Camp with no download required. All of our games are under $10, teach math and social studies. Let your child play on a real computer and learn real-life math. If you're on Steam, be the coolest aunt, uncle, big brother, or sister on the block and download Fish Lake. The little rugrat can play on your computer, learn fractions, and you can get some peace while you talk on the phone to Vin.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars. And we're back with our guest, attorney, activist, former judo player, friend of mine, coach, Karen Mackey.
Yay!
Yay, Karen!
One of the things we're talking about before, too, was law school and going to law school. And I guess, obviously, that is a big decision. And you're kind of figuring out, okay, well, once you're in law school, you know you're going to be a lawyer. But what kind of lawyer are you going to be? And there's a lot of, I know from knowing people that are lawyers and have gone to law school, there's a ton more options than people think. And some maybe make a lot more money than other people think. For example, you go to corporate law and do, I don't want to say really boring things, but every day. But you decided to go into human rights law. And why was that? What was it about that that interested you? Because that's probably not one that other lawyers think, wow, that's a bunch of dollar signs right there.
Well, my first plan actually was to do immigration law. I had worked for an immigration lawyer for 9 years before I went to law school. And it was an area that I was pretty good at. In fact, I had written a petition for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was accepted. Of course, the attorney's name was signed on it, but I did all the work. So I really liked that area of law, but while I was in law school, the immigration laws changed so much that I just really didn't see that as a viable area. And so I was really trying to figure out what I was going to do after I got out of law school for about 4 years. I was a public defender. at one of the local reservations here. And after that, I ended up working for Gateway Computer for about 6.5 years. But while I was there, I was coming up with a game plan, which was to get the job I have now. It was an area I'd always been interested in, but wasn't really sure how to make a viable living at it. So when the then director of the Human Rights Commission retired, I applied for the job. I've never have been so certain in my life I was going to get a job. It, to me, it was mine to get, and I was going to get it, and that was it. And I was right.
And so that kind of throws in one of the things that I have always believed was a secret of success is not giving up. Because you said you worked for 9 years before you went to law school, mm-hmm. and then you did another job. So you were like a public defender for 6 years. It's like 15 years before you got into the thing. Well, and then counting however many years you were in law school. So about 20 years before you got into the thing that you were convinced is what you really wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the questions I get a lot based on the guests we have on our podcast, and people say, well, that's really amazing that that person succeeded despite all those obstacles. But what kept you going when a lot of other people would have given up?
There is a level of stubbornness, I think, that you have to be a woman in judo, in any martial art, especially having started in the 70s. I am a stubborn person. And it's just the belief that this is the path I need to go down. This is what's going to happen. I was probably the most inept judo player ever when I first started. I couldn't fight my way out of a wet paper sack. It was more about continuing to do it and just having that stubbornness to continue doing what you're doing and knowing that eventually you will get better at it. I hated law school. I absolutely despised pretty much every second of it. But I knew it was something I had to get through. And it's one of those things you just have to gut it out.
See, that's really fascinating to me. Because when I got my doctorate, I think I loved every minute of it. I mean, I didn't like being broke, but I really loved the courses. I loved statistics. I loved programming. So, but yeah, when I got my MBA, I did take business law and fell asleep in it. But
yeah.
I thought it was more just because I worked the graveyard shift and it was at 8 a.m.
I actually hated most of the courses that I took. I didn't particularly like a lot of my classmates, shall we say, trying to be generous there. You know, a lot of them were entitled white kids who were younger than me. And I remember this one time I was walking out of the library and I was following a group of law students. And they were discussing what restaurant they were going to eat lunch at that day. I was trying to figure out how to pay rent that month. My experience was a little different than theirs. And yeah, I didn't enjoy really anything about law school other than there were some good friends that I've made from it. But it was something I had to gut it out and get through. And I think one of the things that appealed to the law school admissions committee, actually what I wrote about in my essay about why should they take me in law school, was about competing in judo. And actually, I think it was the 1989 Senior Nationals when I competed in it, and I came in second, but I actually had suffered a workers' comp injury to my back probably 2 months before Nationals. I could barely walk, let alone play judo, and somehow I found myself in the finals match. And I was ahead with 1.5 minutes to go. That's back when they were 7-minute matches. And the next thing I knew, Juanita Cardwell launched this amazing Aochigari. And I kind of came to and she was laying on my face, pinning me. But I wrote about that. I wrote about a failure. And I think they found that intriguing.
That is intriguing that your law school application talked about a failure.
Yeah. It isn't necessarily our successes that define us. It is getting back up after you have failed.
Did you expect to hate law school going into it?
No, I did not. So I was really kind of shocked. I thought I would enjoy it. I had enjoyed working for an attorney. I had found the area fascinating, although I didn't always find all the lawyers I dealt with particularly interesting. In fact, one of the things that really convinced me I could do law school was one time we had a disillusion. So a Someone was trying to get a divorce, and I was handling the case and doing my thing and having to deal with the other lawyer. And I remember thinking, good God, this man's a lawyer. I can be a lawyer. This cannot be this hard. I just have to, you know, pass the LSAT, get a good grade in the LSAT, get into law school, survive my first year, and then pass the bar. Because this idiot has somehow managed to do all that. I certainly can do that.
So did you not like college when you were an undergrad?
Oh, no, I love college. College was fun. Law school is pain in the neck.
Because I guess my experience as an undergrad going to Washington University was kind of like yours in law school. I mean, I didn't hate my classes. I loved learning. But over the breaks, I was working full time to try and make money so that I could eat during the term. And yeah, everybody around me was talking about where they were going to go, if they were going to go to Cabo, if they were going to go to Fort Lauderdale, if they were going to go to Costa Rica. And I was thinking, well, I'm hoping I get a job at Denny's so I can work, you know, 40 hours a week and make some money so that I can come back to school.
Right.
So it was different.
Imagine Karen Mackey, law school advocate.
I take it you're not on the alumni committee.
Oh, I was invited up to University of South Dakota Law School to give a talk at their Lavender Law Lecture last fall. And oh my gosh, I think that I blew their hair back because I talked about what a shitty time I had at law school. A friend of my best friend from law school did that shortly after he got out of law school. He was invited to talk somewhere about going to law school, and it was to people who were prospectively like going to go to University of Nebraska. And he talked about what a shitty time he had and how awful it was.
I'm guessing they didn't have him back.
No, they did not. And I don't think I will ever be invited back to USD.
Well, I think you make a good point, though it hasn't. It was not my experience that if you really want something, maybe you just have to power through.
Yeah.
There was one class that I really did not like when I was in graduate school. It's on qualitative research, basically the creative storytelling side of research. You know, instead of going out collecting data and statistics, you do case studies and stuff. And I was just insistent. I was not going to do it. I was not going to do it. And I remember talking to the dean's assistant and saying, you know, I'm never going to use this and I'm not going to do it. And she said to me, you're right, Anne Maria, you don't have to take this class. And as I got up to leave her office, she said, only if you want a PhD from the University of California, Riverside. Damn it.
Oh, my. Yeah. You know, the thing I liked about law school was my job clerking. I clerked for legal aid and I thoroughly enjoyed that.
So it didn't totally suck.
No, it didn't. But the clerking piece actually wasn't doing legal research. They hired me because of the social worky kind of background that I had and the fact that I was Native, because what they wanted me to do was to go into the foster homes of kids that they were guardian ad litem for. And many of them were Native, but they wanted someone who could go into the homes and interact with the family, with the child, with the foster parents, be able to get along with maybe the biological parents and sort of see what's really going on and make reports to the attorney so then he could make a report to the court.
That's got to be really challenging. I mean, you're dealing with difficult circumstances, people with limited means. Sometimes they're guilty, sometimes they're not, I'm sure. What was that experience and how do you kind of stay positive? Because it seems like that's one where there's a lot of burnout.
Oh, it was interesting. So it was for the Omaha Tribe of Nebraska, which is about 30 miles from where I live. So I had to commute every day. And we handled about 1,500 charges. So I did a little math one time. Not my best subject, but I did. And figured out...
We've got games to help that.
I heard that. And I play them, actually. I have it on my iPad. Because it does help. So anyhow... I figured out that I had about 15 minutes to spend with each client for each charge they had. So if you wanted more than 15 minutes of my time, and we're talking from arraignment on, so you better have a lot of charges or you weren't going to get much of my time. It was absolutely crazy. I did that right out of law school, and I had not been planning to do criminal law. So all I had in my toolkit from law school was the one semester required course your first year of law school on crim law. I had no idea what I was doing. My first day, the person who was leaving the job as public defender was kind of like sitting in with me and helping me. And I had to do a bench trial. It was a pregnant woman who was accused of huffing paint. She was a frequent flyer, I came to find out. And so I had to go in and argue this. And the other attorney gave me a suggestion about how I might argue that. Literally, I met the woman, and 15 minutes later, I'm in court arguing this case, and I won. I don't know how I won, but I did. But that's how things were there. You were so busy, and there were so many cases that you didn't have time for the niceties of legal research, of writing briefs, doing anything in writing. So the interesting thing that meant, though, was that instead of the prosecutor being in charge and being in control, really, I had a lot of control. And it took me a while to figure that out.
Well, because I'll bet the prosecutor didn't have much more time to prepare than you did.
No. So what it meant was we made a lot of deals. And I would get very good deals for my clients because when the prosecutor would start to get an attitude and not want to play let's make a deal with me, I would grind the court to a screeching halt. I'd have a trial. One trial would screw us up for months. So when he realized, and I wasn't shy about saying, well, you want to have a trial, we can do that, or we can get these cases knocked out today. It's your choice. And it didn't make him very happy, but I got great deals for my clients, actually occasionally did some justice, but we did have a lot of people, because of their personal issues, were before the court a lot. I would be surprised every now and then when I would meet someone for the first time, maybe they were on a jury, maybe they were a witness, and I'd never met them before because I thought I must know everyone on that reservation, and I didn't. There was a whole lot of people that had no reason to come in contact with us. But I also met some really, really great people like Mary Webster, who was just slogging away as a social worker. She was head of Child Protective Services, and she was trying her best to make lasting changes on her reservation. So I met some really great people.
And, you know, I think that's true on every reservation where I have been. I mean, it's easy to get a little discouraged when you see a lot of problems, but if you look around, you often see people who are, you know, a gift from God. They are just working so hard and know their job so well.
And there were some good things about working there, though. As hard as we worked, the tribe really did understand some work-life balance things. For example, powwow holiday. Where else do you get paid time off from work because the powwow's this week?
That's true. I've been up at Spirit Lake during Fur Totten days and forget about getting anything done.
Right.
But the powwow's cool.
Well, you know, we get the day off ahead of time, the day before, because, well, of course you're getting ready for powwow. You'd get the entire powwow time off. And then you get the day after off because, well, your family's going to be leaving now and you need a little time. And, you know, they knew people didn't like to come to work like the day before a holiday. So what they do, they would prepare a meal in the building I worked in because that's we also housed the jail. So the jail cook would make a meal. We'd work half the day and then we'd eat. Perfect. Got everyone to work.
Well, and Eric Longy told me that in his Mother's Day, the Indian time didn't mean you came late or you came whenever. Indian time meant you came a day early because he said back in her day, it took a long time to get places.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe people were riding on horses. And so your family was coming. They were coming from a long way away. So you came a day early to visit.
Yep.
We'll be right back.
You know how sometimes you have an idea of how you want something done? Like how you would have your living room decorated, your closet organized, or whatever. But you just haven't had the time to get around to it because the way it is right now is possible and it works. But in the back of your head, you know it could be better someday. Well, for Spirit Lake the game, someday is today. At Seven Generation Games, we've rolled out a major update of our very first game. We've kept the parts that were already great and enhanced those areas where we saw potential for enhancements to give you a new version of the game that we know kids will love even more than the original. If you already have Spirit Lake, check your email for the update notification. If you don't have Spirit Lake, well, what are you waiting for? Get it today.
Welcome to our third and final segment of More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. We still have the three of us, me.
Her name's Marie Burns Ortiz. I'm Anne-Marie DeMars, and that over there is Karen Mackey. She forgot her name, Maria. But this is everybody's favorite part of the podcast, where our guest is put on the spot to give a tip. Your tip can be anything. So go, Karen. What is it people need to know?
People need to know to learn the names of the secretaries and the janitors in wherever they're working, not just in their office, but the other offices in your department or wherever it is you're working, because the secretaries are really the people that get the stuff done. They are the people that make sure the boss does what they're supposed to do for you. And if you piss off a secretary, God help you, because the secretary sure isn't. And a whole lot of people crap all over secretaries to their detriment. And the other people you need to be, make sure you're nice to, are the janitors. Know their names. Say hello to them. A lot of people seem to think it's beneath them to be nice to the janitor. Several years ago, I had an issue at work that someone thought my secretary wasn't working all the hours she was supposed to. And what she was actually, she was a single mom. She was going to school full time and working for me. And life got a little crazy, so she was coming in at night and making up her hours. So, well, first they had the Praxis card that she would use to get into the building to prove that, but the HR person talked to the janitor, and he was like, well, heck yes, she's there all the time. And Karen's there too. They're the only two people in that department that ever work a minute after 4:30. And so he saved my bacon. He's a nice guy, but I was nice to him. I treated him like a human being, and a lot of people didn't.
Now, I've had that happen more than once with certain people. Actually, Maria wasn't one of them, who say perhaps forgot their homework at school, and I had to run up at St. Anne's and have the janitor let me into the classroom to get the thing that my slacker child had forgotten. Or possibly it might have been that I was at a conference once and I forgot some very important stuff that got locked in the exhibit hall. And I had to go and beg the janitor, who's a very nice man who happened to only speak Spanish, to let me in. So, yes, I vouch for that. I have over the years needed help or a copy of a document and called up, and the person I needed to get it from wasn't there, but their secretary said, oh, hon, I can help you with that.
So everybody be nice to administrative personnel, housekeeping,
yes,
janitorial staff, and honestly probably much everyone, because nobody likes a jerk.
Right. But if you're looking for the person to suck up to at Seven Generation Games,
it's me.
I was going to say Diana, but Maria would appreciate sucking up too. Just for the record, leave that in there, Jonah.
All right. Thanks so much.
It's great.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, sevengenerationgames.com. And that's 7, as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary, while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7generationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend, and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.